So we're here with another episode of In a Perfect World, and well, look, it's January 2016, and my God, it's like 2016. It's just powering ahead. We're in this halfway through the decade. Things are accelerating on planet Earth. I really believe we've actually, we're transiting through the tipping point, that we can really all feel that things are hitting the fan everywhere we look. The pressure in the social systems, politics, finances, environmentally, and also socially. So, within the crisis there is opportunity, and within this opportunity there is a spiritual path that is being unfolded for us to learn and to grow. And on my path, I have come across this wonderful woman, Jo Slater, who is my guest here today on In a Perfect World. Jo, welcome.
Thank you, Rack. Welcome. Thanks for having me here.
Great. And so, that was all a little bit of a preface to say, I don't know a lot about you, Joe. We've just met. I know that you live here in Australia. You're on the East Coast like I am, not far from where I live. And you are involved in the entheogenic scene, but you've also come from a neuroscience background. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, Joe.
Sure. I'm pretty new in my discoveries. Essentially, I came from a science and education background, and I was a school teacher, and I had a head injury 4 years ago, and this is where my searching and discovery paths sort of changed everything. I had a lot of time for meditation and trying to work out and explain hallucinations. Essentially, it's the first, and I started searching, the mechanisms, what produces, what brings about hallucinations.
So wait a sec. So before we get too deep into that, that's what I'm really interested in. I looked at you're one of the speakers at the upcoming samara.org shamanic medicine forum in a week or two here in Byron Bay in Australia. And on that, you mentioned, yes, you come from a conservative background. So you were a science teacher, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, mathematics and science. And so, yeah, my father was a scientist, and so I was raised all my life with a lot of chemistry and biochemistry, microbiology. I did human nutrition, but my major was mathematics. So, yeah, I came from a pretty conservative background.
You're right. So I'm interested in that because, I mean, I guess, it's interesting how we find ourselves on this path, however we define it. I use a lot of the language and terminology from the shamanic sort of realms, but also I'm really interested in neuroscience as well, and the work I'm doing with the NGO Terra Incognita and Dr. Juana Costa and others is really looking at this overlap and this unification of, science and shamanism, and I guess what we're calling neuroshamanism. And you have just fallen into my lap and seem to be a beautiful example of this. So you've also sent me, some of your work that you're, I guess, grooming this paper, which we'll get into later, but I just want to introduce this concept. But you've got this paper called The Metabolites of Tryptamine. And, you have done this sort of the endogenous psychedelic neurotransmitters and N,N-dimethyltryptamine and explaining a new pathway to produce serotonin, melatonin, and hallucinations. So that's really exciting because, just from what you've said, coming from your own conservative background and also from, I guess, a self-taught sort of background, you're really forging ahead and really on the cutting edge of some of this neuroshamanic exploration, aren't you?
Yes, yeah. In fact, it's this model that I'm actually nicknaming it divergence because of the divergent action it has on receptors that allows new ways of thinking, creativity, and learning. When these psychedelic chemicals, essentially, that are found in naturally in the body as well as throughout nature, plants and animals, I started questioning why are they a Schedule One drug? Because they're actually found quite commonly in people and animals and fungi and plants and yeah, so it started me questioning why, why do we not know anything about these? And so I started really looking into everything.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So, okay, so let's get back to, I was saying, I use a lot of the shamanic paradigm as well as embracing the scientific paradigm and the unification of the two. But, one of the classic things across cultures all across the world when they have medicine people who are, I guess, the avatars or the intermediaries between spirit and their communities quite often, is that there's a call to action. And this call to action away from the everyday world often archetypally has this initiatory sickness or this, you know, this disruption of business as normal. And the potential candidate for the shamanic role is thrust into a realm of either illness, which then needs healing, you know, the classic, you know, healing sort of crisis. So tell me, what happened to you, you know, 4 years or so ago? What happened with this traumatic brain injury that you endured?
Well, I was hit in the back of the head with a blackboard, quite a substantial hit. It was about a 3-metre metal blackboard. And over time, essentially, I completely stopped functioning. I couldn't talk or understand, communicate, barely walk. And I was in hospital for over a month. And I had changed. During this period of time, there were a lot of fear. I had no understanding what was happening to me. And so it really threw me. Essentially, the whole process was quite traumatic to go through at the time.
So, Joe, what were the effects of this brain injury then? Was it disorientation? Was there memory loss and cognitive sort of, impairment?
Yep. Everything. Photophobic, so the light. I was hallucinating, and so I was hearing sounds that weren't there. I was seeing visuals. I lost my smelling sense altogether. However, I would smell pungent, occasionally smell really pungent, disgusting smells. So I had the olfactory hallucinations happening, and that all those sorts of things were really quite, you know, scary that I was going through.
Yeah, and so did you have, I mean, you're sort of within the medical paradigm there, aren't you? So when these things were happening to you, and, you know, you said you're coming from a conservative background yourself, but you were still, I guess, interpreting what was happening as, you know, brain damage and within the medical model. And what did Western medical science say about your condition?
Oh, this was the worst part of it, actually, that because there's no, in my area, very few people even understand brain injuries, and there was no real support, no help. They put me on different antidepressants, and I tried all the drug system, and all they did was make things worse. And I ended up just going off everything. I was having partial seizures as well in the beginning, and then I had 3 MRIs, a couple of CT scans, X-rays. Nothing showed up afterwards. I mean, initially I wasn't tested, but about a month after, 6 weeks after my injury, I was tested, and nothing showed up in the results in the actual medical, you know, world there. And so, therefore, they said it was psychological, and which was even more distressing. In the sense that there was no answers.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, there were no answers. So what did you do then? I mean, you know, you didn't have that sort of support from the medical establishment, or what about your friends and family, or how did you cope with what you were going through?
I met while I was in hospital, a very experienced psychologist he was a clinical psychologist who had done a lot of cases with traumatic brain injury. Written about 10,000 papers, you know, the cases of people over time, and he specialised in anxiety and depression. So he was there to actually see if I had an injury and if it was psychological or, a physiological problem I had. And he was able to predict when I was telling him my symptoms. It was a classic case of TBI, traumatic brain injury. So he brought great relief in knowing that if this is an injury, then it can heal. I had the hope that it could heal, and so that was my only little hope or avenue that my world, because I didn't have the thinking processes, I didn't have rational thinking at all, I was emotional, and it was it was actually a relief to find someone who had seen all these symptoms many, many, many times before, and he was able to talk me through and help me and encourage me in research. He encouraged me.
And so where did that research lead you? Like, what was the result of, how did you cope with this injury?
Okay, so the research I started doing the best research came after I went to Arnhem Land. A girlfriend was working with a corporation in Nhulunbuy, and she basically just picked me up and loved me back to health, and the Yolngu people up there adopted me, and their way of living, this really simple community-based living, was really therapy to my soul in a way that I'd never experienced before. And I met a man called Jalu Guruwiwi, who was the didgeridoo healing man, and he hadn't met me before and I hadn't met him, and he didn't know I had a head injury, and he looked at me with his didgeridoo and he looked at my head, and he basically said to me that my brain had parted and that he would put back together, and he blew the didgeridoo, and essentially, you know, I was a bit of a skeptic at first, being, you know, from that sort of, you know, background. But when I came back home, I went to a QEEG or neurofeedback specialist, and they looked at my brain and saw all the symptoms and everything. But the interesting thing was that right down the center of my brain was almost zero activity. So what Jalu had said was exactly right, and I got treatment for the motivation area down the centre of the brain, is the motivation, because I had no motivation. And within a very short time after treatment, I enrolled into neuroscience and started studying neuroscience.
Wow, that's an awesome story, Jo. I mean, that's a beautiful initiation that you went through. And so let's get into this then. So your friend that took you up to Arnhem Land, and, you know, for listeners that don't know, there's many different surviving tribes of Indigenous Aboriginal Australians or Indigenes that live all over Australia, and Arnhem Land is one of the sort of larger concentrations of the Aboriginal tribes up there, and there's different tribal mobs or, lands and clans and lineages. And so, I mean, I'm just finding that such a beautiful and, you know, I guess challenging experience, because you're taken away from the city, you've got brain damage, you're describing that you're impaired, and your friend took you out into this remote, I presume, Aboriginal tribe. I mean, how was that for you?
Well, initially, I mean, she has a job and had a home and everything like that, and introduced me to some lovely people, and I just connected, and eventually, as time went on, I actually started living with the people, living like the people, and went out to remote lands where you need very special approval to get into, and haven't seen white men for a long time, and I lived just how as they lived, and living off the land, surviving with very, very small needs. But every day we hunted and we cooked and we just took every day as it came. So they taught me a lot of the ways they have a phenomenal way of communicating. You know, for instance, when we were out there, there was a dingo that came, and the lady, the leader there, she said that such and such had died, and that because that dingo that was his dingo, and 2 hours beforehand he had died. But this is many, many, many hours away. So those sorts of things were happening. They were able to almost communicate, all you have to do is think about certain things, or for someone to contact you or find you, and it's like the next minute you get a phone call. Or when I came back home, this was happening to me all the time, and I was thinking of someone, they would call me up pretty much within the minutes. And it, those sorts of things really perplexed me, because how, you know, that these were seemed like special powers. They had special abilities, and they were highly intelligent people, and they lived the most simple life, and they had such contentment, and they were very strong community and family, and they look out for each other, and they share knowledge, they share with one another. And before I came home, the elders of the lands gathered me together around a bonfire and down on the beach, and they had a song, the Arnhem Land song man, sing his songs, and an interpreter interpret what he was saying. And then at the end of it, they said that we've passed on all our knowledge to you, that they wanted me to go home and share the knowledge and then to come back with more. So they, it was all about the interchange and sharing and helping one another in a greater community, you know. And it was quite fascinating, because when we woke up in the morning, because we all just fell asleep on the beach. When I woke up in the morning, there were tracks of a 15-foot crocodile that had been sleeping right behind us.
Oh, wow.
It'd gone back into the ocean. Yeah, and they said that was a good sign. That was the spirit. That was their, that's their totem, the Baru, the crocodile. And that was a very good sign, because he was there listening with them all night.
So this is just a beautiful archetypal story that shows the contrast between the sort of more materialist Western understanding of cosmology in the world and the Indigenous perspective. And I love that, you know, you were thrust into this world and you've accepted the call. And I'm sort of wondering now that you've, you know, I know that after this initiation you've gone on to study neuroscience, but with your current understanding of neuroscience, what do you sort of, what I'm interested in is, you were, I guess, reduced to, you know, the filtering valve of consciousness, or there was impairment in your brain function, but it left you with more of an emotional body that was in, you know, dominant versus maybe some of the other normal mental abilities. But then with your current understanding of neuroscience, how do you see what condition you're in then, and how that might apply to what you're describing about the Aboriginals' powers or their state of consciousness? Because, you know, in the Western culture, we're so ego-driven and problem-solving and intellect, but we have all these different capacities within our mind. And what are your thoughts on that, and how that might relate to Indigenous people as well?
Yeah, well, so then I did a massive big study, and I looked at hundreds of papers that have been researched, particularly with psychedelics over the last 50 years. Because essentially these chemicals that are in the body, they activate different areas of your brain and everything. So my understanding then led to shamanic practices over in South America, and using ayahuasca, and that was very, very interesting. That's in fact, I read Rick Strassman's DMT Spirit Molecule book, and he had introduced whole new concepts and things with the psychedelics, and so that's where I then really started looking into other chemicals and the relationship with DMT, serotonin, melatonin, bufotenine, which is the hydroxy ion added to DMT. And then looked at other naturally progressing chemical reactions that were like MEO-DMT or MEO-tryptamine. All these chemicals are found in the body naturally. And so the shamanic, using the plants and the MEO inhibitors with the plants, are able to activate these chemicals in the brain, which then leads to really heightened divergent thinking and sensory, and knowledge. It seems to be able to untap innate knowledge that's been stored or inherited or environmental, whatever the processes are for the knowledge that's been hidden inside, and it allows the release of this knowledge.
So this is really interesting, yeah, because even with the studies of neurotransmitters and brain function, traditionally most Western science is still looking at it within a sort of mechanistic sort of Western lens. But, you know, what I think the neuroshamanic approach is discovering is that these biological mechanisms, the neurobiology of them, are actually triggers and catalysts to open up to a whole different realm, which is basically the, you could say, shamanic or spiritual or astral or energetic, but it's like nature has built in the backdoor access to allow us to access the greater energetic web of nature itself.
Yeah, that's, and this is the really big thing is it doesn't exclude that there is an intelligent entity. It doesn't exclude any of those sorts of things. Yet in science, those sorts of things are not encouraged to explore or even consider.
And that's so, right, because, you know, science is meant to be the act of verifying, you know, objective reality. And it's, if they're not willing to actually look into this, then they're not doing science, are they? They're biased.
It's not the pursuit of truth. And that's what true science is the pursuit of truth, of finding out the truth to things and passing that truth on. And that's where we are today with the with Sharma happening, starting on the 2nd of February. It'd be wonderful to have that interaction of different people who have had different experiences yet all can come up with the same sort of experiences, you know, where there's actually an entity, where there's actually something guiding you in these experiences. There is something there that that gives you the knowledge, the education at a pace that you can handle, and it's so gentle and kind and unintrusive. And, you know, it's just something that when you meet together with people and you're sharing these sorts of experiences with one another, you're learning from one another, it can only do good because you're enhancing your knowledge and understanding and eradicating fear.
And this is beautiful because this is part of, you know, what I think is happening in the West is this ayahuasca has been spearheading it and psilocybin mushrooms are really coming up again now and, you know, the DMT research and culture is really on the increase, but really it's shamanic culture and it's community. And I was really, you know, taken by your description of going into the Indigenous Australian Aboriginal community there and what you're describing as their sense of community. And I know that even with the Ayahuasca Project back in the 1990s when Dennis McKenna and Eduardo Luna and others were researching the effects of ayahuasca in one of the first sort of official studies, they did notice that it wasn't just the ayahuasca and the, you know, the alteration of the brain chemistry. It was the support of the community they were embedded in which helped the long-term integration of the healing aspects of the medicines. And then part of that also, I think, is that your worldview opens up. And you know how you were saying that perhaps your mental impairment with the brain damage was there and the emotional body was there. Indigenous cultures recognise that we have an emotional body, we have an energetic body, and that we're not meant to repress these things, that the source of illness or dis-ease or disconnect comes from the fact that we're not fully embracing our full potential and we're repressing it. So, of course, there's sickness and dis-ease. So when we're fully blossoming as a human being, we are embedded within nature and nature is embedded within us and we have a reciprocal relationship and we remember our place in the web of life. And so what you've been describing is the neurochemical catalysts within the tryptamines of the brain, as we described, they're the keys to the kingdom. you know, that allow us to embrace our birthright and to come into the full, you know, beauty and tapestry of the natural world in its full diversity, and to feel it and to become part of it. And as I have felt in my shamanic experiences, as you just said, to be guided by the spirits of either those who have gone before, or the ancestors, or the elementals, or the fact that nature is nurturing and allowing us individually at our own pace, when we need it, to go through this awakening, which is just the most massive paradigm shift we have encountered in 10,000 years, and we are going through this transition now.
Yes, we are. And what's happening is, I don't believe it's coincidence that we're meeting together. I don't believe it's, I think the time now, everything just seems to be coming together. Clarity in research and all the work that's been done in many, many years previously all seems to be just coming to a pivoting point where there is conclusive evidence that that the psychedelics that are endogenous in the neurons and in the body is able to help enlighten and educate and develop new ways of doing things, creativity. And so therefore, as we tap into and we do things that enhance the production, and when I say enhance, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to take a particular chemical. What on the neurotransmitter model I developed, the rate limiting factors or the important things are the enzymes, because if you have an abundance of these enzymes, then your body will create its own natural psychedelics or hallucinogens or endotheans.
Now, this is beautiful, Jo, because this is basically the next wave of psychedelic culture, whether they know it or not. There's a few people across the world. Bruce Damer, Dr. Bruce, is big on endogenous psychoactive, gestation within the individual. Samara.org is going to be doing a whole panel on talking about endo as well. And it seems to be that a lot of the plants and a lot of the medicines have been allowing us to reconnect and remember. But we have, as we've described, we have these keys within us that nature has built that we need to remember how to use. And we are psychoactive. We don't need anything external to ourselves. And that all of this has been spearheading and coming to this point, this focal point of us remembering how to access these abilities within ourselves. So wait a sec. So let's just lay it on the table, Jo. So you went through this experience, your own shamanic initiation. That's my words for it, but it seems pretty archetypal. You were adopted by the tribe in Arnhem Land. You were given the information and the healing. You then went on to study neuroscience. How did you start to get interested in the neuroscience, and what are these results? Before we get into the nitty-gritties of the enzymes, give us the big picture and then we'll drill down into the details.
Well, I wanted to be able to explain the experiences, and it was really important to... That's how I'd been trained, was through science. And so neuroscience, because it was all happening, these hallucinations and things that were happening to me were visuals and things that were in the brain. So I wanted to really understand how does everything actually work at a cellular level? How does it all connect? What produces the brain waves? What produces these, you know, alpha, delta, beta, gamma brain waves?
So wait, Joe, could I just ask, we've described sort of the traumatic brain injury and the dislocation of your consciousness in a way, but were you having sort of psychedelic effects? Like, have you had at this stage, you know, an entheogenic, you know, sort of alteration of consciousness?
I've never had psychedelics, and at this stage, and so it was something in a way. I was a test body for it. For that, you know, I realized there's something that's happening inside my body. It was producing, and I wanted to know why it was happening.
So
and
are you saying you were having a sort of psychedelic effect, but naturally from your brain metabolism?
Yes.
And what was the quality of that psychedelic effect? Like, just generally, like what were you going through?
Well, because I lacked knowledge and understanding, I believe it was projected to the back of my brain as opposed to the forefront. So if I had gone through that same experience now with the knowledge I've got now, I believe there are ways you can project it to the forefront of your cortex to allow the joy and appreciation. I had those sorts of experiences. I did have very small, but there was no real beautiful colours or patterns or things like that. So what it did was put me in the fight and flight zone because it was being projected the wrong way. And this is what fear does. This is what it stifles, that creativity. So by educating people and telling them that the hallucinations or the experiences that you have when you're hallucinating is actually not the big bad wolf that everyone sort of has tended to understood from studies and schizophrenia back in the 50s and 60s and saying that they cause things and stuff like that. But it's actually your body's natural way of producing serotonin and melatonin in a roundabout way. So, for instance, if you're fasting, I looked at some studies that could not explain when a traumatic brain injury person had depleted tryptophan. So they fasted them and they put them in a mode where there was no tryptophan in their body. And they found that the serotonin and melatonin significantly increased by more than 25%. So they couldn't explain why that was happening. However, if we didn't have this alternative route, this route that allows the psychedelic production, then we wouldn't have serotonin and melatonin, so our total sleep and would be in complete depression and to a point where we wouldn't be able to survive. But if you're in a, say a natural environment where you have to survive and you can't find food and you're starving, your body has a natural way of producing these psychedelics that creates problems or allows it to be the psychedelic activation of these diverse receptors allows new ways of thinking and problem solving that that traditionally the pathways would not have gone down. So it creates the new pathways to divergent thinking.
Mm. Okay, cool. So then lead us into your theory that you've developed about the metabolites of tryptamines.
Okay, so because they're serotoninergics and they have the amine rings, it goes from tryptophan. In the traditional model, you have tryptophan, then you have 5-HTP, then you have serotonin. When the enzyme, which is called TPH, one for the body and two in the brain, when that is inhibited and the gene for TPH is in the back of the back of your head there. So when that is inhibited, it means that that enzyme cannot convert tryptophan to serotonin as easily. Or, if it's not there, it can't do it that way. So therefore, it leaves an alternative route of tryptophan to tryptamine. Now, tryptamine has not got any real studies of the mechanisms from there. In fact, it was very, very difficult to even find the tryptamine is produced from tryptophan. It's very, it's not commonly done. So, but it would logically mean that this tryptamine then goes on to DMT with methylation enzyme, and it also can go back to serotonin if it's hydroxyl iron is added to tryptamine, it's straight to serotonin. So it's a very, it's as quick a route as the traditional studies of tryptophan to 5-HTP to serotonin.
So essentially what you're saying is that, the brain can reroute the chemical structure if the original pathway is blocked, and it can do it through this alternate pathway. Could you maybe just give an overview for listeners who don't know the hard science? What are the tryptamine chemicals in the brain? We've got There's about four or five, aren't there, main ones?
Yeah. Well, the main ones are your DMT, your bufotenin, which is hydroxylated DMT. Then you have, from bufotenin, you've got, it loses on the OH part of it, it loses the H and gains a methyl group, CH3. So that becomes 5-MeO-DMT.
My favourite.
It seems to be very divergent. Yeah, it's but interesting, if you actually go from melatonin, so you've actually gone from serotonin to normelatonin or NAS, then you go to melatonin. Well, the vital and the most important step I've found so far is from melatonin to 5-MeO-tryptamine.
So that's different from 5-MeO-dimethyltryptamine.
Yeah, dimethyl has two. It's been methylated twice, so it's a little bit bigger with two methyl groups extra. But this has been shown in studies that this does happen. But it deacetylates from melatonin to 5-MeO-tryptamine. It's that deacetylation process which requires an enzyme called SIRT1, or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7. There needs to be a lot more studies done on this. This is really fringe now. But the wonderful things they've found with SIRT1 is quite phenomenal in medicine. Everything from weight loss and diabetes, cardiovascular, there's a lot of evidence that supports this enzyme as a vital key to health and well-being and anti-inflammation.
So tell me, in the normal brain function, and this is what I've gleaned over the years from both neuroscientists and fringe shamanic practitioners, but you know, they say that the normal brain function is, as you say, there's like the melatonin production in the brain, and that's in the daytime controlling biorhythms and sleep and, you know, things like that. And it has quite a extensive functionality, melatonin. It's quite under-recognized. But, you know, it travels down the serotonin pathways, I believe. And what you know, the Peruvian style, or at least the Shipibo style of ayahuasca usage, is in the full darkness. And in the full darkness, the melatonin sort of is used up, and the dimethyltryptamine or the tryptamine start to be secreted by the brain, occupying the same pathway. But in the normal cascade of the brain, it goes from the melatonin to pinealine, and then the 5-MeO-DMT, and then the NN-DMT. And there's a cascade of tryptamines that are part of the natural cycle of consciousness, and also the connection to consciousness to the somatic responses in the body. So that flush, that cascade of tryptamines, will also have a somatic physical effect on the body. And there's been a few studies that we've been publishing on the Terra Incognita website recently from other varied scientific studies on the immunomodulation effect of NN and 5-MeO specifically, and how that can help flush the body clear and help clear tumours and perhaps even cancers. And there's been some solid scientific research on that. My shorthand for it is, it's almost as if the neurochemical effect is like a God's factory reset. So when you go through this entire tryptamine cascade naturally, then what it also does is flush your whole body clean and restore you to optimal health. It's like there's a symbiotic relationship between the two. But anyway, I'm asking your opinion. What do you think of that cascade of the tryptamines in the normal human brain function?
Yes, yeah, I totally agree. In fact, that's what the model it leads. You can probably spend a few years on developing even more chemicals that from the cascading, and then having to find them in the body, even properly predicting new chemicals that haven't been discovered as well. But essentially, that it's that enzyme in between. Melatonin's also being found to be a free radical scavenger, but then there's other studies that say, well, it can be good, it can be bad, and we may even find with 5-MeO DMT or 5-MeO-tryptamine, I think is a really pertinent one. It will have studies that will show it's very, very beneficial, and it may even have some studies that show it's not, because it's the process, it's the enzyme in that takes it from the melatonin to the 5-MeO-tryptamine. It's the that enzyme. If you run out of that enzyme, so there are foods and things that can produce and increase this SIRT1, and in time we may find SIRT7 is also. There's a whole new line of research in discovering these SIRT enzymes.
So, Joe, what is a SIRT enzyme?
It's sirtuin and silent mating. It's basically a protein that catalyzes from going from melatonin. It deacetylates the melatonin molecule, so it takes off the COO to bring it back to just 5-MeO-tryptamine. So it's becomes a tryptamine molecule again with an oxygen and a methyl group off it. So it's very much like what you're talking about with the 5-MeO-DMT, but it's actually in the what I call the primary circuit from serotonin to melatonin back to serotonin again. It's a very, very small, really quick, easy circuit that allows it to go around. So these enzymes are the ones that if you run out of these enzymes, then your body will slow down in producing these beneficial chemicals. So
you're saying, Joe, if we boost or maximize our native production of these enzymes, we would have a higher concentration of tryptamines in our brain that might endogenously help support us into, you know, the tryptamine realm?
Yeah, and it's a perfectly legal way of doing it.
Yeah. Holy moly, Joe. can we share this with the listeners? Like, what do we do here? Like, what do I need to take?
Well,
what do I need to do?
Well, the wonderful things I've been discovering, kale, a raw chocolate, grape skins, berries. There's a list I'm building now on these beneficial. The concentrations in them vary, obviously, but there are some foods that, if you predominantly eat these types of foods, then it's going to make a significant difference on your SIRT1. And your SIRT1 is the anti-inflammatory. It's basically the beautiful enzyme, the special enzyme. And I've looked at studies in SIRT1 since I predicted it, and I thought, oh, I've got to look at this further. And there was a man who in Australia who did discover this SIRT1. He started a pharmaceutical company over in England and patented 100 SIRT1-derived chemicals. So they either increase SIRT1 or they're very similar to SIRT1. And the largest pharmaceutical company in the world has bought that out. So we are not able to access these chemicals, only special approval to research.
You know, maybe that's for the best, because that's the old capitalist model, and you know, we're in this unity shamanic model. Let's maximize our own body's ability. We don't need someone else to give us this externally. We need to internalize this alchemical process.
Exactly, and this is what we should be doing too, because it's natural. We can find them naturally in plants. We can find them naturally in foods we eat. We don't have to go through those sorts of things. And this, but the
just remind me there, kale? Is it kale? I'm going out to buy a whole chocolate of kale. Is that it?
Yeah. It's some really common things. Eating raw chocolate as opposed to processed chocolate.
Is that cacao type chocolate?
Yeah. That's the good stuff. In fact, it's very beneficial. But because it's been tampered with and processed and commercially sort of, you know, put out there, it's actually the raw chocolate that's been made that is actually very good for you, provided you don't have too much sweeteners and unnatural sugars and things in it.
You know, those raw chocolates as well, like the cacao, that's, you know, South American, Mesoamerican, they use that in ceremonies, they understand and respect that it has an effect on the consciousness and brain, and it's a, you know, it's a spiritual sort of tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's no wonder. because it increases the SIRT1. And
so these enzymes, so the SIRT1 and was it the SIRT6? So if naturally, if we have these in our body and they're healthy, we are going to have a more abundance of tryptamines. And what would that mean for us? I mean, does that mean we're really going to be, you know, launching into the DMT type of, you know, hypnagogic realm? Or does it just mean that we'll have a healthy, robust, functioning brain system?
This is the exciting part, Zach. We basically, this is fringe. This is all hypotheses that have been derived from this model that was built. So we need time to tell. We need feedback from people. And in the long run, we can work out what the body does in any other areas that might be inhibited. So we might be increasing the SIRT1, but there may be other areas that need to be increased, other enzymes that need to be increased as well. So, the model shows the possibilities of the different enzymes, and they may not just be one enzyme that is in the process. There may be several different types of alternative enzymes that allow the chemicals to be produced. But in time, when people eat certain foods and what they have found and the experiences, if we can encourage people to give that feedback, you know, to you, send it in to you, and we can collate it, and this all becomes part of the process. So where everyone needs to work together in understanding it, and it's perfectly legal. This is a process that it's been valuable having these. We need those studies that are with the psychedelic chemicals. They've been a foundation in that, you know, what they do to and activate. Those studies are very vital and important, but there's actually a whole new level opening up, and it's the enzymes that, so it allows that body to, if you need more or less, your body will have ways of utilizing it as to what it needs, and then that way you're not risking overdoses by only using one particular chemical in your body. You can still risk unbalancing the model, whereas if you use the enzymes, your body will naturally produce the right amounts that don't become toxic levels and things like that. So that's where the awareness of possible abuse can happen if it's too much of one particular chemical for your body to be able to eliminate it.
So do we think, you know, this is, I guess what people have posited before is that not just Indigenous people, but in you know, pre-20th century, before electromagnetic frequencies and interruptions in the food chain with GMOs and with processed food and sugars and things which have polluted the natural ability of the body to almost be, you know, an antenna to receive nature's energies and the signal and the information. So, you know, we're getting back to this thing. Do we think that this is at the root of, our ability to have these spiritual experiences if we have the right optimal health from the foods which produce the enzymes which produce the neurochemical reactions?
Well, it would be fair to say that is a very good possibility of being able to do it naturally. In fact, even if you look back in the old traditional ways, that's what they do. Up in Arnhem Land, they don't have fluoride water. They live naturally off the land with natural foods, and they have these experiences. They often report, astro travel and different things like that that they can do. So their body is producing these, this ability to do these, and their spirituality is on a level that I've never met before. Their faith in, or their, it's not even faith; it's just accepted that this is, yeah. There is a very high level of spirituality to the Western world general, from my experience with religions and things like that. So they know that they can do things and communicate, and they can experience that. They do initiation processes, for instance, and it's after the initiation process they they actually cut the skin of the boy, and they put they burn particular plants, and they put the ashes in the cuts, and the boy then is loved by the community and respected because of his strength of enduring this hardship or this trauma or pain. And he then blossoms as a person. He grows into a man, a responsible man, and is retrained. So it would seem now, with my knowledge looking back at this initiation process, is actually a very, well, at first it seemed quite cruel, but it's actually a very intelligent process to go through to make a boy into a man. And if the plants that they use have DMT in them, or other activating enzymes or things that can help produce the new divergent thinking, then that allows the community then, when they embrace the boy and love him and respect him, and he's able to become stronger. And I remember a talk that Ede Fresca did about initiation. He said, when it's coupled with that love and support, it makes, you know, it really makes it stronger. However, if it's coupled with humiliation, then that's what he believes causes post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, that makes sense. So tell me, Joe, did you have, I mean, that's, we talk about, you know, boys to manhood initiation, but was there, I mean, I know with Indigenous cultures there can be exoteric and esoteric knowledge, things they can share with only within the tribe, and even within the tribe, within the males or the females' knowledge. And what did you go through? Like, what can you tell us? And did you go through your own woman's initiation or knowledge and anything like that?
No. In fact, I never saw any sites or anything like that. There was a film being produced on it that I did see what they were doing. That's where it was introduced to me. It was done at the Art Centre there. But it wasn't generally talked about. I'm a female, and so it was acknowledged that these things happen, but the details I didn't experience. And so I haven't done any initiations or anything like that.
What's the upshot, though? They said that they want you to share the knowledge they have shared with you with the world, though, yeah?
Yeah, the knowledge that they shared with me was historical knowledge. It was probably the first level of it. They can't go into even secret. Even people in the community have certain knowledge that they can't share with anyone else. But the knowledge I was shared was a historical. Information. It was information where they came from, how many people in Australia before colonisation, the visitors that came to Australia, things like that.
Mm, beautiful. And so where are you at now? So you've got this paper that you've written, The Metabolites of Tryptamine, and we talked a bit about the enzyme. Is there anything else? You talked about the alternative pathways that you've sort of been exploring of the tryptophan or serotonin tryptophan and to tryptamines. Is there anything else in your overarching theory you want to discuss?
I guess one of the biggest things I'd like to share, and it's to help ease suffering for people, is that hallucinations that people get, you know, psychotherapy and psychiatric help for and things like that. Well, if they just understand that the body has a natural way of producing hallucinogens, and in fact there was a study done in the UK of nearly 5,000 people, and they, from the ages of 15 to 100, and they found that over a third, from 15 to 24, experienced hallucinations before they went to sleep. And then it consistently decreased, consistently, to 65 and plus, which was only about 17% experienced these sleep hallucinations or dream-like states. And so from that, it would seem logical that it's a very healthy process and balance in our body. And it seems to decrease with age, the abilities with age. And we know that the pineal gland gets calcified and different things in the society we're living in, fluoridated water and in foods and all sorts of different things. But the pineal gland is so fundamentally important for the melatonin and serotonin production, and very, very little is known in science about it. Very little research has gone into it. But, you know, it contains a lot of knowledge in that pineal gland. And so to know that hallucinations are actually a good opportunity for you to discover yourself and discover those repressed memories or innate things that have been unresolved, and to find a community of people that love you and accept you for who you are and allow you to go through the process of expressing and being yourself. And in time, you will understand, you will find the answers, you know, and if you are hallucinating, you can project it to the forefront of your brain to enlighten and problem solve.
Well, tell us a bit about that. I mean, is that what you did in your case? So you...
Well, yeah, I guess that's what I end up realising, that this was an exciting thing to go through, and that just that everything seemed so beautiful, the trees, the flowers, the plants, the soils. I started painting. Painting was my, when I had the injury, was basically my biggest therapy. That was what helped me project it, I think, to a greater understanding, because I didn't know what I was painting. I didn't consciously think up what I was going to do. I just did it. And it was the endotheogens in my brain that was basically allowing me to communicate and understand and learn. And as time's gone on, my artwork has progressed and changed and developed. So it went from water of weakness to solid trees and land to neurons and endotheogens and an understanding how it's all connected. And that's the artwork that was what told the story and educated. So, yeah, if you're going through different things, there's many techniques, but I found personally artwork was a wonderful tool. It was the circular, initially I was using circular action. I was making barrel waves representing the turmoil I was going through. I couldn't see any light. There was no light at the end of the tunnel of the barrels. But eventually light started seeping in through the end of the tunnel and colours started coming in. I started using beautiful golds and purples and blues and all sorts of different colours in my artwork. And then it developed from, changed as I learnt and got enlightened, it changed to something more solid and trees and plants, and went to Arnhem Land, and it was all about community and people and customs. And then I went to neuroscience to understand how it all worked.
Wow, what a journey, Jo Slater. Thank you for sharing that with us. So where are you at now? You're going to be presenting at the Samara Shamanic Medicine Forum on February 6 and 7. And I think that event is being webcast live to the world, so we'll put links up in the text accompanying this audio interview. And hopefully people might be able to see your presentation then as well.
Yes, that'd be wonderful. And I'd love to meet people and hear their experiences and talk to people with ideas that they've got. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
You know what it is? It's like the things I've gotten from the conversation we've just had is not just all the neuroscience, but this real deep appreciation of community. And mm-hmm. if you were to approach the concept of community from a neuroscientific point of view, you could probably look at it as a sense of cohesion and this idea that, you know, there's these individual neurons which are all holding. And I was thinking about this when you're talking about Indigenous people. They have filtered knowledge where some people of the tribe will hold the knowledge and other people won't. But collectively within the organism of the tribe, they are then, you know, they're like hard drives for that information, and they have to replicate it over the generations and copy it over. But it's this sense of community. Like, it takes a community to hold this knowledge and to have the speciality of almost in a brain structure, who's going to hold the emotional structure, who's going to hold the data or information structure, who's going to, you know, there's a assembly happening within the community to hold this shamanic knowledge and to embody it and anchor it as we move forward in the 21st century and into the awakening. And I think that's what I've really enjoyed about our conversation, is that there's a neuroscientific a way to look at this sense of community that's developing. So, Jo Slater, welcome to the Global Shamanic Tribe.
Thank you.
Awesome. And is there somewhere, do you have a website or some way that people can connect with you, Jo?
I have an email. I'm working on a website now, and my email is just joleeslater@gmail.com with a capital J, lowercase O, capital L, lowercase E, capital S, lowercase later at gmail.com.
Yeah, beautiful. Because I think, you know, what your thesis on the metabolites of the tryptamines, you've been putting that round to a few different the scientific community, to a few different thought leaders. Yeah. And I think that hopefully, yeah, you'll get some good feedback and we'll be able to develop those theories more and integrate them into the community.
Yep, I'm really hoping so. I'm hoping it. I understand it does take time and planning on how to do it, and I'm working on a few ideas of some experimental things myself at the moment. And I actually want to move more towards, as opposed to the research side of things, I want to move more towards the actual application of the therapy from the model, and using darkness. And and so I'm in the process now of developing I've designed a bunker or a cave, essentially. And
I'm coming to stay with you. That's wonderful.
I need help.
I'll help you. I'll help you. And listeners who live in Australia, let's help Jo out. Let's be participants in her Australian tryptamine darkness ritual program.
Yeah, everyone's welcome. I've got a place here. It just needs lots of bodies on there to do the work and be part of it. It's just, I'd love to.
We didn't touch upon this, but we talked earlier before the interview about this, that, you know, some Indigenous tribes posit that if you're in total darkness for, you know, 7, 9 or 10 or 14 days, that the brain does start to secrete all those tryptamine flushes and go through the cascade. And we were saying that the only one I know of that's commercially around at the moment in Thailand, the tantric master Mantak Chia holds a darkness ritual for 10 days, I think it is. And, you know, you're in a room, you're in sort of like in a house-type setting, a retreat setting, but then the facilitators come around and serve you meals and do whatever in the darkness. And it'd be so cool because you could pipe in music, you could have, you know, facilitation. It's so doable, right? The darkness ritual is so doable. It almost seems a bit scary, but it's like, imagine 10 days in total darkness. But this is what previous Indigenous tribes have learned to do, yeah?
Yes. Oh, well, it's kind of like I wanted to make it actually like a cave where it's actually it's like immersing in the mud, like a sacred lotus plant, you know, from the mud. It's you're immersed in there in a cocoon-like fashion. And then when you come out, you're like that beautiful flower that has so much to offer and medicinal value and people that you have a whole new perception of life and understanding because, like you said, it's totally reset the brain again. It's equalized and balanced everything out again. And then when you come out, it's an embracement from people around. So the ideal situation would be to not only have the this cave-like experience, but then to have a community around you totally supporting and embracing you with what you've gone through and respecting the time it's taken to do it, and it takes a lot, you know, the discipline that's needed to stay in there and to, in a way, suffer and go through emotional purgings and all sorts of different things that you would probably go through in a situation like that.
Well, it's transformational through the pain and the suffering is the release and the transmutation. Hey, do you know of any actual Indigenous tribes that do the darkness ritual?
I hadn't heard of it, no. But I'd never asked. I could ask around.
Where did you get your idea about the darkness ritual from?
From my neurotransmitter model.
Really? So directly from the model. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's led to a lot of new ways of thinking and looking towards. And I've got I've got a theory of how to heal and a combination of things and diet as well as absence of food as well and, you know, all sorts of it's work in progress at the moment and
aren't we
I
all,
believe,
Joe? We're all a work in progress. No, I agree. Well, you know what I might do? I might have to follow this up with a podcast with Mantak Chia to get to the bottom of tantric sexuality and darkness tryptamines.
Oh, nice.
I'll keep you posted.
Awesome.
All right, sister. Many, many thanks for your really valuable contribution to the tribe and being so open and loving, you know, in your approach to this work. And I wish you so much blessings on your path and welcome again to the tribe.
Oh, it's so wonderful to meet everybody, and I really look forward to having new family. And Samara is something that I'm really excited about because that's where everyone will be meeting. So this is my first meeting and such of everybody, and it's very exciting. So thanks so much, Rat, for introducing me to everyone.
It's been a pleasure. All right, many thanks, and we'll continue the discussion in the world. Okay, aloha, Joe.
Aloha.